South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanz on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Tuesday, September 12, 2023. The spokesman of the South Sudan government says the country cannot go for elections.
We can run elections with the current constitution. And then the elected body will be called a constituent assembly.
And some young professionals are giving back to their communities in Western Equatorial State.
We decided to at least have this initiative to bring the message and the knowledge we acquired from our colleagues and the seniors, the professors in Juba.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's Minister of Information, Michael Makwei, says the country can go for elections without a permanent constitution. Makwei adds that the current transitional legislative assembly does not represent the people of South Sudan. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
Speaking at an event in Juba over the weekend, Michael Makwei says repatriation of refugees and drafting of a permanent constitution should not be tied to the upcoming elections in December 2024. His latest statement contradicts some provisions in the 2018 peace agreement. Makwei argues that the current national parliament, made up of appointed MPs, is not capable of approving a people-based constitution.
We can run elections with the current constitution. And then the elected body will be called a constituent assembly, a parliament that will come and write the constitution. After all, if we talk today of going for the current parliament to write the constitution, whom do they represent? This appointed parliament does not represent the will of the people of South Sudan.
The government spokesman says some political parties are using some provisions of the peace deal as a pretext to boycott elections and demand another extension of the transitional period.
Because they are sure that if we go for elections, they will not come back. So the best way is just to continue with the series of extensions.
Albino Boldiu, South Sudan's Minister of Youth and Sports, accuses Sudan's People Liberation Movement in opposition, or SPLMIO, of calling for a fresh extension of the transitional period.
We heard the Macharis' speech recently. He said he doesn't want elections. He said he wants a more extended period of 24 months, which is 2 years. This means, seeing we achieved independence as a nation, we have been going through transition to transition to transition. But for how long? As a Minister of Youth, we do not need more war. We need elections.
Pok Bot Baluang, SPLMIO Director for Communication, says the SPLMIO under First Vice President Riek Machar is ready for elections. He says elections should be held as stipulated in the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement and the roadmap for ending the transitional period.
We are not for another extension. However, what are we calling for now? They're not coming from out of the space. This is all I'm mentioning that. We are calling for the implementation of the peace agreement in letter and spirit, and especially the Brexit leading to a fair, credible, and transparent election.
Baluang insists a constitution is a vital requirement for holding elections and establishing a democratically elected government after 2024.
A constitution that we have now, it is the incorporation of the agreement. The agreement whereby it has chapter one indicates in the government we will have 550 members of the Transitional Legislative Assembly, a government that will have a president, a first vice president, and another four presidents. We need a permanent constitution whereby the term of the president and in the office and the other elected positions.
Presidential hopeful Peter Mayan Majungdit, the leader of the People's Liberal Party and the head of the opposition coalition, other political parties, says it is possible to hold elections in 2024.
I think there's a middle way to go about it. The middle way to go about it is that we can enact an act between now, can be drafted by the Minister of Justice and then come to the cabinet and then come very fast. The act can basically that we can hold the two elections, the presidential elections and gubernatorial elections, and there will also be an election towards legislators.
South Sudan is left with about 14 months to prepare for elections in December 2024. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayer in Juba.
Some young medical professionals from South Sudan's Western Equatoria State are sharing knowledge with their community by training health workers to mitigate shortages of health professionals in the state. Juliana Shiapai visited Budue Health Institute and has this report for VOA from Yambio.
The three young medical professionals who are yet to graduate from College of Physicians and Surgeons of Juba Teaching Hospital have established the Budue Health Science Institute early this year. Mark Kumbonyeki, the co-founder and the principal of the institute, says while at the college, he and his two friends found one dream.
I and my team decided, after completing the HPE program in Juba and waiting to graduate soon, we decided to at least have this initiative to bring the message and the knowledge we acquired from our colleagues and the seniors, the professors in Juba, to bring it down to the community so that our community benefit from the training that we went for. Because before we went, we have a gap. We were having challenges of tutorship and tutors to teach medical students, and we devote ourselves to go and attend the training for 1 year and a half, and we have to come back and deliver the service to our entire community.
Kumbonyeki says he and his colleagues hope the institute will one day grow and attract students from all over South Sudan. He says they started the institute with limited resources, adding that students had to bring chairs from home to attend lectures. Kennedy Ganiko Beime, the deputy governor of Western Equatoria State, visited the institute for the first time on Monday, and he pledged to support it.
We want to start by giving you land. So tomorrow, I need official communication from the institute, then we will show you where the land is. Also, we will support you to get the registration. Already have talked to my colleague, the Minister of Health, National Government, and also my colleague, the Undersecretary of the National Government, and the rest of my colleague in the Minister of Health. They have declared their support to support you and register this initiative as soon as possible.
Ross Obede, Director General of Western Equatorial State Ministry of Health, says the three young medical professionals are committed to deliver rare services to the community in the state capital, Yambio.
We in the State Ministry of Health and all of our facilities, we are lacking. We are lacking cadres like this one to come and take over and help our people. Our mothers are still dying. Our children are still dying. I know now we have hope through this institute to have more capable, understandable, and from the environment to help our people. Because if you bring someone from nowhere, they will not be suitable to this environment.
Malesh Mark Omal, a student leader who is pursuing clinical studies at Budue Health Science Institute, says the school has only 40 medical books for 87 students studying at the institute.
We are facing a lot of challenges. One is the library. The school or the institute has no library whereby to have enough books and the computers for our research and coursework. Then two is at the laboratory. That is for the practical part of it. That is the models. And coach, as we are trying to do some physical examination.
The World Health Organization says in 2001, 789 women died for every 100,000 live births in South Sudan. Jackson Marangba Nicholas, pursuing diploma in midwifery at the institute to help save lives of mothers and their babies. He says there are few tutors at the institute.
Another issue also is resources. Under resources, what I mean here is both human resource and materials. Human resource here I meant is the teachers or the tutors. So we don't have all these funds that can bring in more tutors who can take us in all these course needs that we're having. So it is a little bit challenging to maintain the issue of human resources at our capacity here.
23-year-old Joyce Yesto Elisama is studying nursing at the Goodwill Health Sciences Institute. She says she struggles to raise money to pay her tuition fee.
My major challenge is about the tuition fee. I'm not having a work to do so that to be, or anything to be doing so that to be getting the tuition fee. It is so difficult for me to continue, but with this one, I'm appealing to the anyone who can wish like to help me in my education.
The Institute offers 3 years diploma courses in midwifery, nursing, and clinical studies. The young medical professionals named their institute Goodwill Health Science Institute after seeking permission from the Azande Kingdom in Yambio to name the institute after the King Goodwill Bajingbi, the first Azande king who was killed by the British in 1905. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shapai in Yambio, Western Equatoria State.
Still on studies, the primate of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, Archbishop Justin Badi Arama, says the country needs competent legal cadres to deliver justice for sustainable peace. The Archbishop made the remarks in an event to launch a school of law at the newly established Episcopal University last week. For VOA News, Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Archbishop Justin Badi Arama says the Episcopal Church of South Sudan decided to open a higher institution of learning to help build strong cadres for South Sudan. The head of the Anglican Church in South Sudan inaugurated a school of law at the Bishop Gwin campus of the Episcopal University in Juba. The university will also offer diplomas and degrees in law. Archbishop Arama says the church will use its university to prepare future leaders for South Sudan.
It is our vision that the same way we excelled in offering primary and secondary education, we will do the same to offer university education to young South Sudanese so that together we will be able to rebuild this country with Christian values.
The Episcopal University of South Sudan was accredited by the Ministry of Higher Education in October last year and is running several programs in its colleges across the country. Arama says education is important in building a country once torn apart by conflict.
Plan for the future is to open the main campus at Rukun, of which we have acquired a land 4 kilometers by 4 kilometers, where we will open more schools, we will have business, we'll have education, and we will have all what South Sudanese need so that we together contribute to prepare the young generation to take this country and Africa in the right direction with Christian values.
Eva Maria Jones, the university's vice chancellor, says the institution will be a symbol of unity where South Sudanese from various communities come together and interact.
It is a university that will help build peace through higher education in this country, provide young people with skills that they can contribute to the work of building up this nation, as well as learning to live and learn together from the very different places and backgrounds that they come from.
32-year-old Richard Ring is studying law at the university. He says he chose the Episcopal University because of its Christian foundation.
I know all over the world, Christian universities, they have good values. I just don't want to do just a law, but I want law with the moral values of to be a God-fearing judge and to be a God-fearing person.
The university administration says it is ready to admit more than 200 students into its law school. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, more people were killed during floods in Libya. Stay tuned for latest update on that story after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. From economic hardships to company buyouts, so-called news desert are spreading across the United States and contributing to a rise in misinformation and decline in trust in media. For VOA News, Scott in Marion, Kansas, Laura Bowman has more.
A chilling raid that sparked a firestorm. That's how media across the U.S. and Europe described the raid last month on a small-town newsroom in the U.S. state of Kansas as police investigated a complaint by a business owner. But while the August 11th police action against the Marion County Record is relatively rare in the United States, analysts say that it underscores the role media play and how a decline in local news outlets is affecting communities. The raid comes as news outlets across the U.S., and particularly in the Midwest, are struggling to survive. The country has lost around 2,500 newspapers since 2005 and is set to lose another one-third by 2025, according to the Northwestern University Local News Initiative. Their closures often are the result of a hard economic climate and the rise in internet use. The trend creates so-called news deserts, where towns no longer have dedicated regular coverage of municipal and regional affairs. With no reporters to cover city council or school board meetings, people lose a vital source of information, says Emily Bradbury of the Kansas Press Association.
So that's why the general public should care and why it is so important, is it is a true watchdog for the public as well as a way to inform the public about what is happening in their communities.
Newsroom raids are rare, but analysts are seeing a rise in lawsuits and seizures that they say are hard for smaller media outlets to push back on. Another issue, declining trust in journalism. Again, Bradbury of the Kansas Press Association.
This is a bigger societal problem, that we have a real divergence of opinions on what is fact and what is opinion.
But in towns that still have a local newspaper, their role as public watchdogs matters. The Marion County Record has served its community for 154 years. It remains a family-owned and run newspaper. Eric Meyer is publisher of the Marion County Record.
Before this ever happened, our circulation was up. Our ad revenue was up. There aren't very many newspapers that can say that. The reason it is we tried to be an honest-to-God newspaper.
The relationship between local outlets and the communities they cover is important, says Tim Stouffer of the Kansas Press Association.
A lot of these places are really, I don't know if I want to say ignored, but they don't get a lot of attention by, state and regional outlets. So who's left to tell these stories? Who's left to tell the first draft of history? Lives here are important. People matter. The relationships are unique.
Deb Groover, who reports for the Marion County Record, agrees.
Being informed is important. And, who's going to cover a 2,000-person community other than a local newspaper? And a chain couldn't do this.
For some analysts and journalists, the Kansas raid served as a wake-up call on the importance of protecting local media. For Liam Scott in Marion, Kansas, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
2,500 people injured from Morocco earthquake since 1960. Search teams from Spain, Britain, and Qatar joined Moroccan rescue crew. The remoteness of many of the worst affected villages has made the rescue efforts more complicated. Martin Jay, a British journalist, editor-in-chief of the online media outlet Maghrib.org, tells VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi how difficult the rescue mission is.
Well, it has made it more complicated and harder because in many of these villages on the foothills of the Atlas Mountains, to get them, you have to obviously climb an incline, but on many of those country tracks, those paths, they were blocked by earth falling off the side of the mountains due to the tremor. And sometimes they were actually burst open by the actual earthquake itself, you know, leaving a sort of a ravine perpendicular to the routes, making it impossible for vehicles to pass. So many of those villages were cut off even from local people. So it took a while. It took some time for the authorities to actually understand the real scope of the earthquake when they concentrated really most of Saturday, the wee hours of Saturday morning, completely on Marrakesh. It wasn't until sort of through to Saturday afternoon when they begin to understood that the impact of the earthquake was much, much, much bigger over a much broader scale, you know, covering a big part of southern Morocco.
With access routes cut off, the Moroccan army has been using drones and helicopters in a bid to reach people, but due to the large number of villages, it has been almost impossible to get to everyone in time. The top priority remains finding survivors under the rubble, a duty that becomes more difficult as time passes. How difficult is this challenge?
Well, I think the search for survivors, nobody's going to say it. Nobody's going to officially declare it. But I think after 48 hours, you're no longer searching for survivors. You're recovering bodies. And yesterday, I was with a team in Amazmiz in the South Morocco, where the fire brigade and the army and a huge earth-moving equipment were trying to find the body of a young girl underneath an entire house that had collapsed. And, you know, they finally did get to the body. But I don't think anybody now is thinking about finding survivors. I think we've passed that threshold now. You know, now it's a different mission.
Martin, while the earthquake's epicenter was in a mountainous rural commune, its shockwaves reached the nearest major city, Marrakesh. Many of the ancient settlements' buildings have been badly damaged, especially in the old Medina, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, where some of the city's most important landmarks date back more than 800 years. Can you walk us through the damaged historic sites?
Part of this area of Marrakesh, often referred to as the Medina, the building disciplines that were used to build those houses and the materials were very basic and very traditional. And so, of course, it was very easy for the earthquake to knock a lot of those buildings down. And it's a tragedy that we've lost a lot of that. And, of course, the part of the mosque falling down as well. But it threw the spotlight. The cultural issue kind of managed to throw the spotlight on the question of whether the earthquake was really all about knocking down traditional buildings. And now, as the days have passed, we're seeing that hundreds of these traditional buildings on the sides of hills have just fallen, cascading onto one another. And that's what's really called the big numbers. I don't know if you can hear in the background, but these are army helicopters now flying over the top of my house, going north, southbound, going back to the Atlas Mountains, doing search and rescue missions, bringing in essential equipment, materials, food and blanket, and often shipping out dead bodies.
Morocco initially delayed asking for foreign aid. Other countries such as Spain, France, and the United States, even neighboring Algeria, which broke off ties with Morocco 2 years ago, have now offered help. How do you assess the international response to the Moroccan disaster?
I think the Moroccan elite, they could have been wiser, they could have been smarter, they could have obsessed less with the geopolitics of the region and the relations that Morocco has with certain European countries like France, you know, which are relations with an all-time low. I think history would have judged them better if they would have just pushed all these relations aside and just let as many foreign international countries come in, and especially countries that got experience. You know, we saw that with Turkey. You know, the Turks didn't waste any time in letting in the Brits, Americans, and some of the GCC countries. The other element of it is it's hard for His Majesty King Mohammed to ask Spain or Britain or any big European power for military assistance, because that then throws the spotlight on the subject of military hardware and what the Moroccans have and what they don't have. And that would be difficult for the Moroccan elite to accept when given that they would be projecting themselves towards Algeria as an inferior player when we talk about military means. So there are many nuances to why it hasn't happened. And, you know, and the little bit that has happened, unfortunately, tragically, is too little too late. I think yesterday, 60 experts from Britain, earthquake experts with dogs, I think if that could have happened almost immediately, in the early hours of Saturday morning, we would have seen a lot more people rescued.
That's Martin Jay, British journalist, editor-in-chief of the online media outlet Maghrib.org. He was speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi. Hundreds of workers in Ngok, a special economic zone in Gabon, are protesting low pay and poor working conditions and asking for the military junta for help. Their protest comes 48 hours after Gabon's military leader, Brice Oligui Nguema, announced education would be free. Muki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Gabon's national TV reports that hundreds of disgruntled workers are gathered at the head office of the Special Economic Zone at Nkok this week to protest poor pay and what they call a hostile and stressful work environment. Nkok, near Gabon's capital Libreville, hosts a range of industries, including agribusinesses, chemicals and plastics, pharmaceuticals and timber processing companies. Emile Leocadie Musadji is Gabon's Director General of Labor. She said on national television yesterday that protesters want an immediate improvement in their work conditions.
Jusqu'à ce jour, le revenu minimum mensuel demeure à 150 000. On dit le revenu minimum mensuel demeure.
Musadji says the protesters are complaining that some workers earn less than $100 each month when the minimum wage in Gabon is $250. She says some workers are protesting that they have been working for several years without labor contracts and are either dismissed abusively by their employers or not taken care of when they are ill. Protesters said they are particularly unhappy because foreign workers in the zone, including Indians, Chinese and Europeans, are given special privileges such as lodging, transportation, health care and better salaries. They told Gabon National TV that only a small number of African workers are given special privileges. Ken Terence Ipomga Bodi is the administrator and director general of the Nkok Special Economic Zone.
La législation en vigueur au Gabon prévoit effectivement que des entreprises mettent à disposition.
Bodi says Gabon military leader General Brice Oligui Nguema has given assurances that he will solve all problems raised by the workers within the shortest possible time. He urges the workers to return to work and give Nguema time to improve conditions for all Gabon citizens. Bodi spoke on national TV. The protest began less than 48 hours after the military leader announced government schools would be free when the school year starts on September 18. Nguema said that eventually private schools will be free. Mark Ona Esangi is an activist and founder of the environmental group Brain Forest. He also leads a coalition of environmental groups in Gabon. He spoke via a messaging app from Libreville.
Le Gabon est capable de procéder à la gratuité des frais de scolarité, de payer les bourses à tous les enfants.
He says besides free education, Gabon has huge natural resources which, if well exploited and managed, can also offer free health care and scholarships for school children in the country of less than 2.5 million citizens. Esangi also says that during the six decades when President Ali Bongo Ondimba and his father Omar Bongo Ondimba led the Central African State, the benefits of those resources were unevenly distributed. The military junta says free education will bridge the gap between the rich and the poor that has existed since Gabon got its independence in 1960. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday, September 12, 2023. We now leave you with Mawa and the song Benia. Don't forget to visit VOA Africa for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Peter Heinle, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
The way she makes me feel, this girl loves me.